What notable elected officials in Washington were baseball fans?
Well, elected officials, I would probably say the top one would be George W. Bush.
That was in Texas.
Well, he was the owner of the Texas Rangers.
Yeah.
He was the owner there the last year I was with the Rangers. But he was still president when I joined the Nationals. George W. didn't come to any opening days, but he and his entourage would frequently come to the ballpark. And here's what they did. When the president's coming, and everybody knows it, metal detectors, security lines, it takes forever, traffic. George wouldn't do that to our fans. Unannounced. And we had people with the club, security people, who knew about it, but nobody else knew. All of a sudden, we'd be doing a game, and about the third inning, my producer get in my ear and says, "Hey, George W. and Condoleezza Rice and some of their other buddies are in the owner's suite. We're going to take a shot of them. We're not going to show them real long, but I think we need to acknowledge that the President of the United States is here in the ballpark." So we would do that, and they'd leave before the game was over, get out of there, get back to the White House, and that's kind of the way George W. handled it. I mentioned in 06, my first game in D.C., Vice President Cheney threw out the first pitch. I met him down the dugout, introduced myself. I said, "Hey, I'm the guy that's going to be introducing you, and great to have you with you. Give President Bush our best and all that." 2009, Barack Obama had just been inaugurated. He threw out the pitch on opening day, and then he came up and joined us in the booth for about 15 minutes. I would not call him a big baseball fan. He's a basketball, golf guy. But he was very cordial, treated us very well. So I'd say on the rank, those are the three elected officials on a big-time basis. George W. definitely first as far as baseball. Cheney second, Obama third. But, we had Mark Wayne Mullen. He came up to the booth. I got to know Mark Wayne a little bit. He brought his boys up at my invite one time, and he hung out with us. But there were other guys there, John, names you will recognize, who are huge baseball fans in D.C. When we clinched the division one year, Wolf Blitzer came into the clubhouse. He was a close friend of Mark Lerner and his father, Ted, our owners. Actually, that night, I was up in the booth. I was not covering the celebration downstairs, but I saw Wolf Blitzer, and I said on the air, "Evidently tonight, the Nationals clubhouse is the Situation Room." Well, I saw him a couple days after that. He loved it. He said, "That was so great what you said about my show."
Right.
Charles Krauthammer, wheelchair bound, huge baseball fan, huge Nats fan. I only saw Charles during the playoffs because I wasn't doing the games, but I'd be around. But Charles is another one who would come after the game started and leave before the game was over because he didn't want to inconvenience people and get in the way. He was a huge baseball fan. Probably my most favorite of all, the great columnist and author George Will.
Yeah,
George grew up in Central Illinois. He grew up a big Cub fan.
Yeah,
I'm from St. Louis, so George and I had the Cub Cardinal thing kind of going with each other. We'd rag on each other a little bit, but George told me growing up in Central Illinois, his dad would take him to Chicago on the train to go see the Cubs. He grew up a diehard Cub fan, always was. George was a frequent visitor to our ballpark, at least twice on every homestand. Often he and I would sit down in the media dining room and have dinner together and just chat. We love baseball. And he'd ask me, he knew I knew the history of the Cardinals and the Nationals. And he kind of adopted the Nats, but the Cubs were always his number one team. He eventually wrote a book about Wrigley Field called A Nice Little Place on the North Side. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a Cub fan to enjoy it, but if you're a baseball fan, it's a really fun read. And one thing that he pulled out of that book from the research he did, he said the Cubs were such lovable losers for so many years. Their attendance didn't always mirror the one loss record of the team. He said, but their attendance totally mirrored the price of beer. And during summers, when the beer was cheap, they were showing up. And when the beer was more expensive, they weren't filling the ballpark. And I'm like, how did you find that out? It's unbelievable. Between Wolf Blitzer and Charles Krauthammer and George Will.
Tell them who Krauthammer was.
Charles Krauthammer was a conservative pundit.
Yep.
He was on different networks at different times. I think widely respected by many because he was a reach across the aisle kind of guy. You know, not like some of the total sellouts to the left or to the right, like there are now. Charles was more of a in the middle guy, and people had a lot of admiration and respect for him.
Yeah. Other sports play by play people, or color analysts that you have met, like Bob Costas or John Sterling of the Yankees, Al Michaels. You knew John well?
I knew John. I have a picture on my phone of John coming to our booth in Yankee Stadium about 3 years ago. And he came and we sat for a while. I knew John way back when he was in Atlanta. It was really sad, you know, that we lost him last year. Old-time radio character guy. He wore $800 suits to the ballpark every night, impeccably dressed to the nines to do radio. On TV, he would have been a hit. A true character. True character.
I must confess to you.
But I never met Al Michaels. Our paths never crossed.
I must confess to you that I'm a big Yankee fan.
The Yankees win.
Yes, right.
And I saw a video one time on Twitter. Somebody knew the game was about to end and the Yankees were going to win. So they got out their camera and they zoomed in as much as they could on the booth. Because I always wondered, what was John doing at the end of the game while he was doing that crazy thing? Mm-hmm. And he would stand up, and his arms were waving around like he was having some kind of spasm attack. And that's how he did the Yankees. And that was when it was kind of weird at first. But again, John, if you're around long enough and you come up with something that's kind of clever, kind of different, I think eventually people take to it. I think that's what happened with my home run call and with John's call whenever the Yankees got that last out.
At ESPN, you were paired with many former major leaguers. Joe Morgan, Jim Palmer, Ray Knights, Frank Viola, many others that had been
fun. Oral Hershiser, Rick Sutcliffe, guys who became really good analysts. Tony, I got to work with Tony Gwynn, just a prince of a guy. One time, this happened in Baltimore, and I think he did a couple of games, and then he decided he didn't like it. So I'm in Baltimore, and it's an American League game. Why they did this to him, I don't know, because he never played in the American League. All he did was beat them in the World Series. I got paired with Bob Gibson to do a game in Baltimore.
Wow.
So, you know, I never saw Bob until we got to the ballpark. I was trying to get a hold of him to see if he wanted to have lunch or, you know, meet at the hotel. I never saw him until we got to the game. And then, we spent some time together, and I kind of told him my role at ESPN was I was the new guy. I was the guy they gave all the new analysts to. I never achieved what I would call stardom at ESPN. I was more of a utility guy because they knew I could do football. I could do basketball, soccer, baseball. They even put me on some things as a reporter, and I did some studio anchoring. I did College Game Day in 1989. So they knew they could depend on me to break in the new guys, help them out, set them up. So we had done a rehearsal, and Bob and I we're standing up in the booth. We're probably about 2 minutes away from going on the air, you know, and Gibby, you know, he's a little uneasy. This isn't really his purview. Is that what they would call it? Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I grew up watching you. You know, he knew I was a St. Louis guy and all that. And I said, I am totally amazed that you are standing next to me right now. He said, why? I said, you hate the media. He was known as being real gruff and real short with the media. And he was one of the first guys, along with Steve Carlton and a couple others, who were kind of grumpy. And if you asked him a dumb question, he would just, you know, give you that glare like he's ready to put a fastball, you know, right in your chin. And he laughed, and it kind of broke the ice. And I said, you're one of us now, at least for the next 3 hours. You know, so let's have fun and enjoy this. And I always found out, John, that working with ex-players, not only the respect thing I talked about earlier, they were depending on me to kind of get them through those first couple of games. First game for a new broadcaster as an ex-player, they've never done this. You can do practice games in the studio, but it's not like it. I think if they know they can depend on me, that really kind of broke the ice. And that night with Gibson, it worked, and with others, it did as well. You know, or I'd tell a stupid dad joke or something like that, you know, just to kind of get things going.
Mm-hmm. The sports pages of newspapers are really critical, too, to a baseball team, particularly we're talking about. So the Washington Post, was their coverage, were they supportive of the Nationals or were they antagonistic? How did they support it?
I think they were. I think it would fall not as far as supporting and not as far as antagonizing. I think it was kind of in the middle. But, you know, hey, the print media, man, they will point out, like, if a guy's 3 for his last 33 and, you know, batting 100 over the last 20 games, you're going to know about it. Now, they're not going to write, this guy really stinks. But, they, you know, they'll take the same approach we do. Why is this happening? What's happening with this guy? You know, and it's for the comments section for the fans. Oh, send him out. Send him back to AAA. He doesn't belong in the big leagues. Blah, 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 blah. You see a lot of that on Twitter now. You lose one game and everybody should be shipped out. The manager should be fired. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way of social media. I think the Post has been fair. I've gotten to know all their writers who've covered the team over the years. One of them was the senior guy, Tom Boswell. Great, great writer, Hall of Fame all the way, whatever sport. He was more of a columnist than a beat writer. But Barry Sferluga, who's now a columnist, he was our beat writer for a while. And there's been a whole procession of young people after him. I think they've been fair. The Washington Times has been more of an online thing. I really haven't had much interaction with them. There's a paper in Baltimore now called the Baltimore Banner. It's not like the big Baltimore Sun or anything like that. They're covering the Nationals on a pretty regular basis. So I think the media has held them accountable, maybe not antagonizing, but holding them accountable. And they've been pretty rough on the Nats over the last 6 years for constantly losing. But I think some of it is deserved. And now everybody's, now that they got this good young team that's surprising a lot of people this year, they've been playing at or near 500 for about the last month and a half or so. Now the media and the fans are waiting to see, are the owners going to do something at the trading deadline to try to get this young team, which is at least a year and maybe two ahead of schedule, into the playoffs? And if they don't, it could get a little antagonistic over the next month or two.
Right. But then in Washington, you really connected maybe with the town when you go around the city. I mean, we only hear about the elected officials and the Capitol and the White House, and there's a town there. We forget about that.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about Washington. If you're the water boy for the football team, you're probably better known than the play-by-play guy for the baseball team. I mean, it is really an NFL town. I would say second in line, maybe other than 2019, is the hockey team, the Capitals. They've got Alex Ovechkin. Looks like he's going to play another year. Broke Wayne Gretzky's scoring record last year, the all-time leading scorer in the NHL. Probably nobody will ever score that many goals again. The Nationals, I think, are right there with the Caps. And then come the Wizards, the NBA team, and on down the line from there with the WNBA team or whatever, you know, the soccer team, whatever. For about a couple, I'd say for almost two seasons, I felt like a fish out of water there. And I was criticized, oh, he's a Midwest guy. What does he know about the East Coast? You know, some fans were calling me Sunshine Bobby because he never gets mad at the team. He never criticizes like he should, you know, being on the East Coast. You know, there's an East Coast mentality, and there's a Midwest mentality, and there's a West Coast mentality. And in the Midwest, you know, we tend to be a little more polite, and we don't jump to conclusions and, you know, throw guys off the cliff because they went 0 for 15 in a big four-game series. So, you know, I got a lot of that criticism. And I don't know when it was, John. I don't know at what. Maybe it was 2012. And that was my seventh year there. That's the first time we made the playoffs. That's when I kind of felt like, okay, they don't want to shoot the messenger anymore. They kind of like what I'm doing. And it kind of went on from there. And as I mentioned, from 12 to 19, we had some really good years. But I, even over these last six seasons, the fans have been very kind. They've shown me a lot of grace, and they've said really great things about me. You know, when they say, oh, Bob was a legend and all that, you know, to me, the legends are the one hitting the ball out of the ballpark and throwing the no-hitters. And then to be that kind in a place that can be pretty critical, like D.C., and some people believe me and some people don't, and whatever. But I spent more time, I spent twice the time with the Nationals than I did with the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. So the Cardinals will always be my boyhood team. It's where I grew up. But the Nationals, Washington is my baseball home. St. Louis is in second place to that. But, you know, I don't see why you can't have two teams. And I have a World Series ring from the Cardinals, and I have one from the Nationals.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, as a Cardinal broadcaster, if I could ever just get a World Series ring from the Cardinals, that'd be so great. And now I have one from them, and I have one from the Nats. That's kind of the way it's going to be.
The fans paid tribute to you. They wore yellow hard hats in honor of your last name. They wore tool belts, inflatable hammers, and Bob's Carpenters was a big sign.
I had no idea that was going on. I'm thinking that was maybe about 8-10 years ago. I can't remember the year. There was a ball hit into the outfield seats one night, and one of our camera guys spotted these guys. And it wasn't like 50 people. I think it was like 10 or 12 guys. But they were dressed up like carpenters, as you said, with the inflatable hammers, because I suppose you wouldn't be allowed in the ballpark with a real one. And I'm like, I was laughing about it because somebody asked me, did you know anything about this? I said, absolutely not. And I had totally forgotten about that until you brought it up. I think it lasted most of that season, whatever year that was. But it was kind of fun. It was kind of amusing, and we had fun with it.
Absolutely.
I just wished I could have gone out there during a game to meet with them,
right,
or get them to stick around after a game. But I don't know that I ever met with any of those guys face to face.
You were a 3-time Tulsa Sportscaster of the Year, 2-time Emmy Award winner in St. Louis for the Cardinals baseball, 2014. And 2015, Washington, D.C., Sportscaster of the Year. 2017, inductee into the Oklahoma Association Broadcasters Hall of Fame. And then in 2025, as we mentioned, name attached to the TV booth at the Nationals Park. In 2025, Legend of Broadcasting, the National Press Club in D.C. gave you that honor.
That was pretty cool. My only disappointment on the night, they asked who I wanted to introduce me. And I was so hoping George Will could be there. George had another thing going. So my old producer from ESPN, Michael Vetter, introduced me. As I mentioned, my other great friend from ESPN, Ellen Beckwith, was there. We all sat together. And we had a nice dinner, and then we did about an hour and a half. I didn't really get up and give a speech except to thank them for the award. But we basically sat around a huge table with about 40 people, National Press Club members. Their knowledge of baseball blew me away, and some of the attention to detail they threw my way. That was a really cool thing. So that was the third week of October, right after the season had ended, and I haven't been back in D.C. since.
Do you miss the game now?
I do. I don't miss buses, Ubers, hotels, and even though we're on charter planes, on American or Delta, I don't miss midnight flights to the next city after a horrific loss on getaway night.
Yeah.
I don't miss that. I'll tell you when I miss baseball, John, it's about 7 o'clock every night. When I was holding that mic, little adrenaline going, you know, waiting to get on the air, and then boom, you're off doing a ball game. I don't know how many baseball games I did, 5,000 or 6,000. I'm not sure. But who gets paid to do that?
Yeah.
And somebody asked me about that. I was at a broadcaster's summit in North Carolina last week to accept that D.C. Sportscaster of the Year award. The National Sports Media Association is based in Carolina. They have a big banquet and seminar every year. And I was doing a seminar for some young broadcasters. And they're like, how do you keep your edge when you're down 8-0 in the fourth inning and the whole thing has fallen apart for you? And I tell them, it happens for me before that. Every day I went to the ballpark, you know, we're human, we have families, we have stuff going on. I said, maybe I didn't have a great day. I said, but I get out of my car and I look up at that ballpark and I say, you know what, right now hundreds of young people are getting out of their car at minor league ballparks, college ballparks, high schools where there might be 6 rows of bleachers or whatever. And they're excited because they're getting paid to do a game tonight. Maybe they're the PA announcer. I said, if I don't kick myself in the butt every day and pretend how lucky I am, or tell myself how lucky I am when all those other people have a dream and they're out there doing that, that's what I should be doing, and that's the way I approach it.
Right. As you look back, what are you most proud of?
Well, this time of the year, 2 World Cups. I have gotten back into soccer for the last couple of weeks, and I haven't done soccer. I haven't done any soccer since 1994. 32 years ago was the World Cup I did. But I think maybe, John, from kind of an overview, I got to do 7 NCAA basketball tournaments, 7 or 8 college football bowl games. But I think doing 42 years of baseball is not easy to do day after day after day. And before I ever became a baseball announcer, I always wondered, can I keep it fresh? Can I keep it interesting? And can I keep our fans engaged, win or lose, every night for 6 months? And I think the ability to do that is something that any baseball announcer who can pull that off should be rather proud of.
How would you like to be remembered?
I would like to be remembered as somebody who the fans felt when they listened to me, they were listening to a friend who they invited into their home, and we had a great evening together.
Yeah.
Nothing terribly complicated. Hey, a lot of guys out there have done thousands of games and done this and done that. But I think I connected with our fans because I always went the extra mile for them to take when there was a trade made and we lost a big player. Last year, our manager got fired right as we embarked on a road trip before the All-Star break. I always tried in my broadcasting to think of the fans first and speak to them before I tried to sound like the smartest guy in the room with all the stats and all the other stuff with which we have to work.
Well, I want to thank you, Bob, for this. I always think about how people begin their journey. And for you standing there as a 14-year-old boy, that'll always be in my head. And to watch your great career. I admire you a lot and what you've done. You've been put in very high-profile positions. Nerves perhaps got to you at times and all, but you did it. And here you stand as a very professional baseball man. So thank you, Bob, for adding your story to Voices of Oklahoma.
Well, thank you, John. You know, I've been here 50 years now. So I'm an Okie. I got here Memorial Weekend of 1976, and I guess it's apropos that you would ask me to do this after I've been here for 5 decades, which Bob, this was going to be a whistle stop, and now it's my life. And Debbie said, "We're never leaving here. We're going to die in that house, and we're gonna be Okies." But you know, for your legacy and that voice of yours that meant so much to me for many years, to be able to share this last couple of hours with you has been a real treat for me. And all that respect flies right back across the table at you. So thank you. Yeah,
that's mutual. Super. This was fun. Thank you, Bob.
Loved it. Hey, John, I forgot one thing. See you later.
That's perfect. Great way to end it.